Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
BBC World Service. The Second World War may have ended over 70 years ago, but in places its legacy seems in some ways as strong as ever. And nowhere more so than in Germany, where Nazism caused the war and carried out terrible crimes against humanity. I'm Chris Bowlby, and in this programme I'm exploring how post-war Germans have faced this appalling inheritance from history. I'll be discovering how a search for justice in relation to Nazi crimes has continued despite heavy pressure to stop. Alongside all that, a powerful culture of remembrance has emerged as each new generation makes its reckoning with the past.
We do have people who make headlines with like, yeah, let's forget about this, it's the past, let's move on.
As much as we all digitize things and only live in front of our screens, the power of the actual place where something happened will never vanish.
When Nazi Germany was defeated in 1945 and the horror of the Holocaust emerged, one of the victorious power's first thoughts was to put the regime on trial. At a special military tribunal in the city of Nuremberg, new legal principles were applied.
And in which they are charged with crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, you must plead guilty or not guilty.
Bekenne mich im Sinne der Anklage nicht schuldig.
Defendant Hermann Wilhelm Göring, on the counts of the indictment on which you have been convicted, the International Military Tribunal sentences you to death by hanging.
Hermann Göring was one of the most prominent Nazis to be prosecuted. He committed suicide in prison before his death sentence could be carried out. Many of those on trial were defiant, claiming they hadn't known what was really happening or hadn't been in control. These would become familiar arguments in Germany, as was the claim that the Nuremberg trials were simply the war's victors imposing their will.
My name is Mary Fulbrook. I'm Professor of German History at UCL, University College London, and I've recently completed a book entitled Reckonings, Legacies of Nazi Persecution and the Quest for Justice. The Nuremberg trials were seen very much on the part of Germans as being simply victors' justice. The Nuremberg trials were extremely extensive in scope. They were trying to bring a lot of the major decision makers in different areas, not just the top political leaders, but the top levels of the administration, the military, doctors and so on, to trial, to show that this was a whole system of collective violence. And obviously, given the huge scope of the crimes of Nazi Germany, they could only bring a few representative individuals for each area to court. But it was intended to be highly comprehensive.
As was a process called denazification, a huge investigative effort started by the occupying powers to identify and root out Nazi sympathisers from across German society. But very quickly, says Mary Fulbrook, the policy changed.
Denazification was just too big a job, and very, very soon what had happened was that the little people had been caught. The big fish got away with it, as usual. Very, very soon, they start shifting priorities and looking at other things. And by the early 1950s, again, late 1940s already, former Nazis are rehabilitated, reintegrated, wherever they were.
In the eastern part of Germany, the GDR, occupied by the Soviet Union, the communist government tried to improve its image by declaring its zone Nazi-free, even though it still had prominent former Nazis living there. And in the western zones of Germany too, occupied by the US, Britain and France, new Cold War priorities took over.
Within a few years of the late 1940s, early 1950s, the Western Allies and the West German government in particular were running in tandem with each other, beginning to reduce sentences, to commute sentences, to grant early amnesties, to let those who'd been sentenced out very early. So that by the early 1950s, the Western Allies and West Germany saw the Cold War and the fight against communism as infinitely more important than dealing with Nazism.
So in both East and West Germany, many of those guilty of Nazi crimes were never prosecuted. But some further trials were held later, suddenly revealing what had not been faced, putting pressure on the authorities to renew the pursuit of justice. In the late 1950s, for example, a trial in the West German town of Ulm highlighted the wartime massacres of Jews and other local civilians in Eastern Europe. And that trial drove the creation of a remarkable but little-known state agency, still working today.
Well, we have a very complicated title. It says Central Office or Authority of the Land Judicial Administrations for the Investigation of National Socialist Crimes. Full stop. And we're really hidden behind that wall, and that's kind of symbolic for the situation in the 50s, in the 60s, where the population in Ludwigsburg or elsewhere in Germany was not very supportive or openly against these investigations.
When this institution first got going, the idea was to do your work quite quietly, quite discreetly, behind a big wall.
Yes, and quite safely. There were even attacks against the institution. Predecessors were under police protection and had even to carry a gun.
I've come to Ludwigsburg in southern Germany to meet Jens Rommel, a lawyer who runs this central office for the investigation of Nazi crimes, set up despite the hostility of many Germans who preferred in the 1950s and 60s silence, often guilty silence.
A public trial in summer of 1958, where two things became clear. We can't say that all crimes have been dealt with, that there are lots of crimes that have not been yet investigated or properly investigated, and we need a central institution that would deal with these cases.
So this was a trial which focused in particular on the so-called Einsatzgruppen. These were before the death camps, that was the murder of many people in Central Eastern Europe by special units. And this brought to attention the fact that many people who had been involved in that had not been brought to justice.
Yeah, the Einsatzgruppen were units of police members and others recruited for the purpose to fight against any kind of opponent, and these opponents were like teachers, lawyers, priests in Poland, or communists in the former Soviet Union. That was the sole reason to get persecuted then by the Einsatzgruppen.
And some of the most notorious massacres, women and children as well, in places like Ukraine.
Yeah, Babi Yar, for example, is one of the most known massacres committed by the Einsatzgruppen. Mobile units who had then the task as well to kill Jews or Sinti and Roma, labelled gypsies at the time.
From its creation in the 1950s until today, this investigative unit has been collecting a mass of information, and it prepares dossiers about individuals suspected of Nazi crimes still alive, which it passes on to prosecutors. This is, not surprisingly, hugely sensitive material, carefully protected.
So it's here behind this walled door. You can
that's
see
a
it's
very
it's
solid
it's
door,
like
which you're saying, my goodness,
a door
that's
like a wall
several
in
centimetres
a bank.
Thick. It is exactly like a bank, yes.
And you have to put your special chip here. To
so very high security.
Well, we have more than 717,000 names here, not only defendants, suspects, but also witnesses. We have almost 28,000 crime scenes, locations here, and more than 4,250 military or civil units from the German Reich.
Almost 28,000 crime scenes. What's striking is the vast amount of information they've accumulated, but the relatively tiny number of prosecutions that have resulted. One of the best known was of John Demjanjuk, accused of being a guard at Nazi death camps, extradited from the US to face trial first in Israel and then in Germany in 2009. He was found guilty of being an accessory to the murder of thousands of Jews, appealed, and then died before the appeal could be heard. Ludwigsburg had played a key role in assembling the evidence.
That's a small file room with ongoing investigations and recent investigations, and that's why the Demjanjuk case is still here. That's the basis for our current approach.
And many, and many volumes of
you find
files
here.
Counting away.
Yeah,
quite a
35 folders. And you would find here our investigations summarized in a report for the public prosecutor's office.
Who then took the
All the information stored in this extraordinary place makes it one of the great archives of the Nazi catastrophe. It's also a sobering reminder of how many crimes have never been punished. But the legal side of Germany's reckoning with its past is only part of the story. Step outside, into German society today, and you find the debate about the lessons of Nazism is still continuing. Just down the road from Ludwigsburg, it's break and football time at a local school which specialises in foreign languages.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Mrs. von Lessing.
OK.
But while the language the pupils are practising today is English, the history they're discussing is very German.
Has Germany learned anything from the past? This is especially interesting for the 1950s and 60s, the time that we want to talk about today, but it's also really important for today, yeah, because we live in a Germany that...
They're debating why it was that 1950s West Germany, under Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, turned away from more vigorous prosecution of Nazi criminals. Education about Nazi crimes, human rights and good citizenship was always seen as a key foundation of a new democratic post-war Germany. And here's that idea still in action today.
In 1951 there was this new law called Integration of the Old Elites, which meant that civil servants and soldiers, they got back their old jobs. But how can this be a step forward?
It's a good question, but you can't like really see who's a Nazi and who's not a Nazi. Like,
Ex-Nazis were also let out of prison. There's, for example, this one SS officer that went back to the German intelligence agency. Leonie, you talked about the new democracy with Adenauer, right? But there were also two people, for example, Hans Klopke. He became the new leader of the chancellor office from Adenauer, so the new democracy, you called it, is also influenced by ex-Nazis.
In all, it's bad, but look, we have different opinions in a democracy. Different opinions. Before, it was like just one party, so the National Socialists, which were against everybody. And now it's like we have all the different opinions, which is good, because then we don't say like, yeah, you have this belief, so you are not included in the government. Democracy forms all different opinions.
But would you really say that's a good way to...
Whilst these impressive 15- and 16-year-old students were debating, I stepped out into the corridor and talked to their teacher, Katrina von Dessin, who's struck by how this kind of debate changes as German society changes.
If you just have a look at this classroom, it's actually very special because there are many who are not of German descent. So they talk about various other issues. One question that comes up very often is like, what did Hitler do with the Muslims? So it's fascinating for them to find out that there were no Muslims in Germany at that time.
And just one thought about this lesson here, which is particularly focused on the 50s and 60s and the judicial process, what did and didn't happen. That still seems an interesting subject, does it? This idea that there was a time when there could have been a particular reckoning with all this. Let's investigate what German society decided to do and what it didn't do.
Exactly. To understand that it hasn't always been like this, that history lessons in the 50s and 60s were very different, that it was a taboo subject to talk about things, but at the same time they managed to get old elites back into old positions. It's probably difficult for them to understand. I'm looking forward to what they make of the arguments. But it also shows, like, yeah, it's difficult as a society to come to terms with this, because if you put people on trial, you have to face your own questions, and why didn't I do something about it?
Well, let's go in and see what they are making of the arguments.
Yes.
And right now, when you see, like, the right wings, you don't see a progress. You see a step forward for the right wings, because, and they are rising, there is physical damage against refugees, and they just change the enemy, and now it's the refugees, the Islamic religion, and all the others.
Yeah, but to what are you comparing those? Yes, to what time?
Yeah, to the time where Jews were killed, because they don't look like they are not the same race as we.
Yeah, so you're comparing neo-Nazis nowadays and in World War II.
Yes.
Yeah, so we see a progress. Just
okay, now they just hit them and don't kill them. Now it's okay when they just only hit them.
This idea is going to be in our society for a long time.
I guess you could go on debating for hours and hours.
My name is Carmen Nasse, and I'm the principal of Ferdinand Porsche Gymnasium in Stuttgart.
The head teacher here knows that even her school's identity is caught up in the endless debate about the Nazi past. It was named after the famous local car manufacturer Ferdinand Porsche, but the company he founded had its own dark Second World War history.
The Porsche factory also employed slave labourers, as you call them. That really caused a problem to some people, because they said, well, someone who employed people like that during the Nazi era cannot give his name to an institution educating young people.
Very interesting reminder of the 1960s, really, wasn't it? A kind of classic case of how far do you let that history change everything, or do you actually allow a certain continuity?
Exactly. And the Stuttgarter Zeitung wanted to have an interview and wanted me to say yes or no to that name. And I said, well, it's not black and white. What I say is, of course, I'm not happy with what Mr. Porsche did, but it doesn't really help to say we do away with the name and that's it then. My aim was to actually do projects and to have an idea of what he really intended to do, why he acted the way he did. That's why we took a group of students to the Porsche company and had access to their archives to actually have a look at original footage to get an idea how difficult it really was to run a factory. It was a totalitarian regime, so you can't just say, well, I don't work with you, thank you very much. So there were loads of things he had to keep in mind, and I'm not saying it was right. But it's too easy to say, no, we do away with that name and then that's it.
So the idea being an open discussion with all the facts rather than what often happened, which was either an uncritical celebration of something or total silence.
Exactly.
So this school has done its own bit of confronting the past, breaking the silence, a silence that often left crimes like the brutal treatment of slave labour more or less unpunished. Hundreds of thousands from many different European countries were forced by the Nazis to work in key industries. Historian Mary Fulbrook gives the example of the industrial magnate Friedrich Flick, who'd made a fortune under Nazi rule.
When he died, he was probably the richest man in Germany, one of the richest in the world, and he had never paid a single cent of compensation. He had employed 48,000 slave labourers, 80% of whom died on the job. That's the conditions of slave labour. 80% died on the job. Those few who survived never got a cent of compensation from him.
And does slave labour remain one of the most striking examples of an area of Nazi crime that is simply not addressed? And an area that actually was almost certainly very visible to millions of Germans during the Third Reich, because these people were everywhere, nearby, in town, cities, working areas.
Yeah.
And yet it was almost wholly unaddressed for many decades.
Slave labourers were visible for all to see because they would walk from the concentration camp to a site of employment, which may be several kilometres away. They would walk along ragged, starving, clearly being beaten. And it was quite obvious for anyone around to see that this was not a secret. And it was one of the groups that was the latest to be recognised. And so in the 2000s, you start getting symbolic payments, which are a form of admitting moral responsibility, but not admitting legal guilt. And this is very typical of the whole West German way of approaching this: moral responsibility for the past, but not really guilty.
Thank you. Pressure from abroad sometimes forced Germany to do more to confront the Nazi past. The capture in Argentina in 1960 and trial in Israel of Adolf Eichmann, a key figure in the planning of the Holocaust, received huge international attention. It revealed how Nazi crimes had involved not just a few sadists, but a whole complex of bureaucrats making constant moral compromises. But German society was still divided over whether prosecutions and investigations should continue, or whether a line should finally be drawn. There was also a generational split. Those who'd lived through the war, often traumatised, rarely wanted to look back. But younger generations sensed that in their own families, as well as in German society, awkward questions needed answers.
It took a new generation of young people, the children of those entangled in the Nazi regime, to address their fathers, mothers and grandparents about what they did during the war and during the Nazi era by the late 60s.
Dagmar Hoverstedt knows all about how Germany confronts its past through her work with the authority researching the records of the East German secret police, the Stasi. But from her personal experience growing up in West Germany, she remembers how each family had its own version of that hugely sensitive encounter with the Nazi past.
I was too young to ask my grandfather, who was a Nazi Party member, about his past. He died when I was 14. He was my favorite granddad. I was just about to ask those questions when he died. He was a prisoner of war in Russia. I came back 2 years after the end of the war. He was a man of great ambitions, coming from a small family, and I'm pretty sure this party offered him a lot of self-esteem. You know, it's family history that gets to talk about on holidays or on occasions, but I had never had a chance to confront my grandfather.
It's interesting, isn't it? So it suggests in your family, as far as your parents were concerned, there wasn't the silence that's often talked about, that it was too close. They would never even try to talk about it to their parents. But the grandchildren, in your case, they could then approach it in a new way, and they were educated in a different way. And so even if you couldn't have the conversations, you were motivated to research this and try and understand it yourself.
If my grandfather had lived another 5 years, I think I would have made it a spectacle, because I was this young, very emotional, completely against the Nazi era person. And if I said, "You are a Nazi," and I would have run out the room, shut the door and just run out and cry and say, "I will never speak again to this man." You know, so I had this very German emotional idea about this. Now I would love to talk to him, because I really want to find out how he could have fallen so deeply for such a wrong idea.
And that question, why so many fell for such terribly wrong ideas, has haunted families, law courts and historians. In the second half of the programme, we'll encounter this great German reckoning with history in another fascinating form, how the country's culture has wrestled with the Nazi past.
The documentary is just one of our BBC World Service podcasts. There are many others to choose from.
The situation in Iran is at the top of the news agenda.
Qasem Soleimani was killed on the orders of President Trump.
But what is the context?
Khomeini understands us.
Khomeini is a traitor.
Last year, the BBC World Service made a podcast drama, Fall of the Shah, about the Iranian Revolution in 1979.
We don't have to be afraid now. Look at us.
To hear how it all began,
we have profoundly misunderstood this country.
Search for Fall of the Shah wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, let's return to the documentary.
BBC World Service, I'm Chris Bowlby. Welcome back to part two of Germany, Justice and Memory, a programme about how Germany has confronted the history of the Second World War and the Nazi regime. We heard earlier about how far Nazi crimes were pursued or avoided legally and politically, and how schools and families approached this acutely sensitive history. But sometimes what brought more openness about the past was much more unexpected. I discussed with historian Wolf Kaiser how just such a moment came in 1979.
There was a TV series about the Holocaust, a Hollywood series, shown in Germany in the 1970s, which had quite an effect, didn't it?
That's true. It was shown in Germany in 1979. Some TV stations were not ready to show it. The Bavarian one didn't show it. Right-wing extremists put explosives to the facilities for broadcasting this TV series. But the vast majority of Germans wanted to see it, and it was really broadly discussed. And I think the first time people really realized that this was not about numbers, it was about human beings.
I'm going to try and get you some new identity papers.
Inga.
Then we can move somewhere else where they don't know us. Bremen, Hamburg.
Inga.
Then you can work.
Inga, you're dreaming. It is the same all over Germany. Synagogue of Munich destroyed by fire. Citizens group.
Berlin filmmaker Klaus Raffler remembers seeing the TV series, simply called Holocaust, as a boy.
It was a big, big success, and millions of Germans watched it, and they started. It became a big national-wide debate that it happened, that it was there. And yeah.
Why did it have such an effect, do you think? As someone who now makes films, what do you think made a difference about this particular
because
series?
It was very emotionally told. It was the family vice story, I remember that, and it was told how the situation became more and more dangerous with that family. It was a normal German educated family, and they were Jewish.
Previously, the overwhelming scale of Holocaust history, with millions of victims in death camps located far away in the East, had created a convenient sense of distance for many Germans. In a TV series like this, they could see that the eventual murder of Jews and others began with hundreds of small steps of persecution all over Germany, affecting individuals and families. Not only were Nazi victims becoming better understood and identified, so too were the perpetrators of Nazi crimes. Realisation grew that for the Holocaust to happen, a whole society and the way it was run was corrupted from top to bottom. And that idea of the Holocaust as a kind of bureaucratic monstrosity is very apparent here, at a museum called the House of the Wannsee Conference. In this elegant villa next to a lake, a crucial meeting of high-ranking Nazis and civil servants was held in 1942 to discuss cooperation in the deportation and murder of European Jews.
My name is Eike Stegen, and I work with the House of the Wannsee Conference,
and I'm a historian.
The Wannsee Conference is important in so far as that in the center of Berlin, in the center of the German government bureaucracy, this is the highest ranking session on the Holocaust.
So what's in this document here?
It is the invitation letter to the Wannsee Conference. It was sent from Prague, which is the city where the one that invited to the Wannsee Conference, Reinhard Heydrich, is the local ruler. And he invites the permanent secretaries to the ministers from the most important German ministries from the Nazi Party and the SS to have a talk about the final solution of the Jewish question, followed by breakfast.
And that's an extraordinary thing, seeing those two things together when you know what they're going to be talking about, and then, oh, and we'll have breakfast afterwards.
Definitely. Adolf Eichmann, in his testimony in Jerusalem in 1961, says that after the meeting, they stayed a little longer and they put a toast with cognac on the good atmosphere of talks that they just had, and that they smoked a cigar.
It's the details that make an impact. Casual references to eating and drinking amid such appalling work. Decisions leading to mass murder, dressed up with euphemisms like special treatment. Elsewhere in the museum, documents show how this kind of corruption spread into every corner of German life. Eike Stegen showed me an electricity company document.
You have somebody up here who works in the company that would supply Berlin with electricity, would have its own forms, as we can see here on the board, about evacuated Jews and how much money that evacuated Jew, and let me be clear, that murdered Jew in Auschwitz, who had already been gassed in Auschwitz, would still owe the electricity company because they had claims. Huh? You may have done your payments in advance, so you owe the company something because you used more electricity than you had paid for in advance. So the tax officer who had confiscated your belongings would hand over that money to the electricity company. And as you can see on this form, there are stamps and signatures of different officers.
It's been through the whole process.
Exactly, that were involved in handing over that money.
It's just, it's so shocking to see something like that. And it's a specially commissioned form headed report about evacuated Jews.
Yes, exactly.
A notification, if you like. And it's a bureaucratic form, specially printed.
Yes.
Calculating the electricity bill for a woman who was been taken to a death camp.
Yeah.
In early post-war decades, as mainly top-level Nazis were put on trial, many Germans chose to believe that their country had been led astray by a few crazed ideologues, while most people had no idea what was really happening. Today's museums and memorials challenge that view directly.
Some of the most effective memorials are not put in special places, but they're deliberately located in amongst daily life. And here's a good example. This is Grunewald. It's a suburban railway station. It's a place that people commute from. There are people coming to and from work with their bikes now. People might come out here for a walk amongst the woods. And just at one of the entrances to the platforms, it's marked, like any of the others, platform number 17. But go up these steps and you find something that is, in fact, very different. Here you find what looks at first sight just like another platform, not in use anymore, but the suburban trains just nearby. And then on the metal surface of the platform, you notice a series of inscriptions. And here it says, 6th of September 1944, 39 Jews, Berlin to Auschwitz. Next door, the 12th of October 1944, 31 Jews, Berlin to Auschwitz. And it goes on and on and on. And you realise that from here, thousands of Jews were deported to the death camps in the East. People have tried to personalise this a little bit. Someone's just left a piece of paper here, secured by stones, saying, Willy Nossen, age 27, born 1917, murdered in Auschwitz, deported from here. And you suddenly realise that this was going on almost to the end of the war, right next to where people were commuting to work or coming for their leisure activities, here, in plain sight, for those who chose to look, the Holocaust was happening.
There's one particular very successful memorialization idea, which is called the Stolpersteine, right? The stones that you stumble across.
Dagmar Hoverstedt works for an agency studying East German history in Berlin and takes a close interest in all the German capital's memorials, including those to the victims of Nazi deportation.
They are a very recent phenomenon. They are little 10 by 10, 20 by 20 centimeter metal placards that are put in the pavement. And then you step out your door, you read the name of a Jewish person that used to live there and was deported from there. So you confront your everyday life on the historic site with an experience that happened there 70, 80 years ago. That, to me, is tremendously useful because as much as we all digitize things and only live in front of our screens, the power of the actual place where something happened will never vanish.
There are huge, more official memorials in Berlin, like the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe, a major tourist attraction right in the city centre. But for those who live in Berlin, like filmmaker Klaus Raffler and musician Udo Scherbel, it's the hundreds of scattered, more informal memorials that really give everyone pause for thought.
They are important because they are so obvious. When you enter a house and you have to wait there for a minute till somebody opens and you look down and then you see those gold-coloured stones and then you just read a name And then it says Ruth Schmidt, Auschwitz, and the date when she probably died there. That woman lived in that house. It will be very, very important in the future to tell those stories so that it emotionalizes.
If it's history, it's only a fact. But if you see this stone, something starts in you because it could have been you.
But as well as remembering the victims, Dagmar Hoverstedt believes a more difficult historical challenge also needs constant attention. Understanding how and why so many people collaborated in a murderous Nazi system.
It's made up of hundreds of thousands of individuals who make a decision to follow in the footsteps of what somebody wants. So in order to understand it on the individual level and then to see how as a mass, you know, it really changes society, that to me is interesting. But in the end of the day, you have to ask every single person, why did you make that decision? To follow or to resist or to keep silent? What makes a human being stand at the ramp in Auschwitz and decide that it's a normal job to kill thousands of people every single day in this horrific way?
And some of the most horrific revelations to emerge more clearly since the war's end are how members of trusted professions, legal, academic, even medical, became essential parts of the Nazi regime. Auschwitz may have become the dominant image of the Holocaust, but there's a memorial near Berlin, created just a few years ago, that shows how gas chambers were first used in a very different setting.
There, the ovens were installed, and the chamber was not, it was, the chamber for killing was not as big as the foundations, because the foundations are the foundation of the whole barn.
But this is the town of Brandenburg, around an hour from Berlin in what was East Germany. I'm at a memorial to euthanasia victims, looking at the foundations of a building with Dr. Silvia De Pasquale. It was here, in a place where shops, cafes and dance halls remained open during the war, that the murderous technology of the Holocaust was first tested, before the death camps were created.
That this place was selected is rather curious, because it's in the middle of this town.
Over there we can see shops, cafes and so on.
Yeah, there was a cafe, people were dancing there, there's a church, people were sitting in church there, and at the same time people were killed here. It's unbelievable. To kill people with gas didn't happen far away from the center of Germany. As you can see, this is in the middle of a city, and this city is in the middle of the country.
And less than an hour from Berlin.
Less than an hour from Berlin, and the first killings with gas did happen here.
Whereas it was very commonly said after the war, that all happened a long way away in the east. We didn't know anything about it.
We didn't know anything about it, and of course people knew something about it. This was not clearly said, okay, we have here installed centers where people are to be killed, but it was something like an open secret. People knew something strange is happening here.
The victims of the gas chambers here from 1940 were mostly the mentally ill, those with learning difficulties, people the Nazis saw as weakening the population and therefore unfit to live.
And we can see pictures up on small memorial posts here to put a human face to the victims.
Nazi leaders looked on approvingly as medical staff pretended what they were doing was a kind of normal procedure.
It was a medical action, which for us it's not easy to understand, because to kill people, why should it be part of medicine? But it was propagated as part of medical treatment.
Doctors fully involved in selections, no, that kind of thing?
They are the ones who have to carry it out. And the doctor had to be the one who was opening the gas. Nobody else was allowed
to
do
extraordinary.
That.
So that was pretending that this was in some way still a kind of professional medical procedure.
Yes, it is. It was important that the carrying out of the murder is a medical procedure, and is only a doctor allowed to perform this.
in January 1940, all the people came from Berlin to see how does it function. On the one side, there were people killed in the gas chamber. And at the same time, there were people killed with injections. Of course, for doctors, it is more compatible to medical practice. A doctor is used to, in his daily work, injections. But he's not used in his daily work to open a gas chamber.
That's vital to newer understandings of Nazism, how a doctor or a bureaucrat, as well as a soldier or a Nazi party member, could come to see as normal what was in fact horrifically criminal. And that understanding has in turn fed back into the judicial sphere as final attempts are made to prosecute surviving perpetrators.
These were crimes organized by the state with thousands involved. That means that everyone has to share that responsibility, that culpability.
In the first part of the programme, we met Jens Rommel, who heads the central office in Ludwigsburg in southern Germany, still investigating Nazi crimes on behalf of the German state authorities. He knows that the last surviving individuals who were, say, death camp guards are now in their 90s and could not have been high-ranking individuals during the war. But continuing the investigations is still seen as a duty.
It might seem unfair when we look at the history of our attempts. Many high-ranking, with great responsibility, with individual killings of thousands, got away. We are now dealing with the youngest and lowest, and over the time that might look unfair. But that does not help me today. I have to find my way today to deal with these crimes.
But does that prompt opposition from within Germany as well to the continuation of this institution?
Well, there's one question that follows me from my first day in private and in the professional background is, what do you want with these old men? And there's a simple legal answer. Parliament has decided in many steps that there are no statutory limitations to murder. So we have a democratic decision that they shall be prosecuted till the end. So that's the legal reasoning. But I think it goes beyond that. We have, as a society, to deal politically, morally, with these crimes. And I think it's still an obligation to the current German state to deal with these crimes organised by the former German state.
In early post-war decades, law courts were influenced by the reluctance of German society to face the scale of Nazi crime, and German law required proof of direct individual responsibility for acts of violence. But more recently, the law has been changing, partly in response to terrorist attacks. It's now become possible to secure the convictions of those who were simply present at scenes of mass murder, without direct proof of their personal responsibility for deaths. And the commitment to continuing prosecutions has taken on a new significance as German politics changes. Populists from the AfD party, now holding seats in the German parliament, have questioned openly how far Germany should continue to focus on Nazi crimes and what they call the Schuldkult, or cult of guilt. So do younger German generations feel all this discussion of the past is becoming less relevant? A question for Berlin student Lucia Neuenhuis and travel writer Aritzu Weitholz.
We are all talking about it a lot. Also talking about what's going to happen in the future when, like, contemporary witnesses are dying, what's going to happen? And then I read something about, like, holograms in America. They created those holograms where witnesses are talking about their experiences to be able to talk to people who lived through Second World War, and also to maybe keep that intimacy, or maybe, yeah, for the future generation. And of course, also, like, having in Germany, we have the AfD now, we have political parties that are dangerous, and that there's Holocaust denial again, like, which we never thought would happen, never have thought that anything like that would be possible again.
And is there a feeling that this, the idea that actually it's about time we stopped, as Germans, talking about this so much, almost being seen to apologise for this, is that idea gaining ground?
Yeah, the AfD party uses that high sensitivity of the rest of the Germans as an argument. They quoted, jetzt schwingen Sie wieder die Nazi-Keule, meaning, oh, now you are pulling out the Nazi club again, sort of like making the argument harmless. The AfD is insisting that we stop making a fuss, which I think is highly dangerous.
I'm back in the Ferdinand Porsche School in Stuttgart, where earlier we heard a debate about why post-war Germany had failed to take action against many Nazi criminals. Teacher Katrina von Dessin ended the discussion by picking up on one pupil's comment about whether all Germans should continue to feel guilty.
Before we go to what maybe we in 2019 can learn or have learned from the past, Lily,
like all the education system that they inform people what happened and to avoid like something that this thing could happen like twice. And
exactly. David?
I think we don't have to feel guilty anymore for the things that happened in the past.
For decades, your passport equaled your guilt. So this has changed a lot, especially young people whose families aren't even German. And I hope that you walk out of my class at the end of this year and say, well, I have learned a lot about this time, but I don't feel guilty. I do hope that you feel something else, but not guilty.
So what difference will it make when all those who were adults during the Nazi period are dead? When no more victims are there to tell their stories? When no more prosecutions of perpetrators of Nazi crimes can be made? Will this history still be remembered and understood? The school's head teacher, Carmen Nasser.
I always feel that it makes a difference to have personal contact with these people. We have Zeitzeugen programs, meaning that you have survivors of this era in the classroom, for example. Of course, you can watch YouTube videos and all these things are here. I mean, in my school days, we didn't have access to that amount of media footage of the Second World War. Now that's all there, but still personal contact is still very, very important. Yes, and it worries me a lot. Because these people, they can still say, well, I survived it, I saw it, it's true. You know, we are talking about this fake news thing as well. Some people might say, ooh, media footage, how do we know it's correct? Maybe it's not that correct. And there are a lot of things people talk about in the media which are not really true.
We've had Holocaust denial for some time.
Yeah.
And so, that as an educator, that worries you.
Yeah, really, it does.
And for Dagmar Hoverstedt, the need to understand what made Nazi rule possible is losing none of its relevance.
It's all just individuals with their own desires and defects and dreams of what to do and their fragility and their susceptibility to the wrong ideas. Things can just move very easily in the other direction. And we're all connected to being human and having human nature. And so these little everyday reminders just say, don't think it's just something completely different and these people were aliens and have nothing to do with you. They just lived even in the same house, right? And it happened to them. So be aware, you know, just because democracy is not the strongest if you're not willing to protect it and fight for what it means to you and the values of it.
Over the post-war period, there have been many omissions, evasions, guilty silences in Germany's struggle with its Nazi past. But alongside all that have been moments when law courts or politicians or filmmakers or memorialists have suddenly and dramatically reminded everyone of why all this still matters. Why each generation, however distant from the terrible events of the war, needs to learn, in its own way, to heed history's warning.
those that say, come on, we gotta let go, ignore the fact that for almost 70 years now, Germany has made great experiences with looking at the faults of the past. And make no mistake, if you try to ignore it, it doesn't disappear. You know, it's there. You may as well just look at it, take it out of the dark shadows, put it on the table, look at it and see what went wrong, look for the mistakes and try to learn the lessons.
I'm Chris Bowlby, and the producer of Germany, Justice and Memory was Jim Frank.
Thank you for listening. There will be more from the documentary podcast soon. If you haven't already, please do subscribe. And don't forget, do try our other BBC World Service podcasts too.